Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com on the internet. I want to thank all of you who joined me last week at the William Saroyan Theater downtown for that Sounds of Freedom Band concert. I want you to know that your donations and through all the sponsorships, the donations collected there that day, approximately $10,000 will go to local veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan because of your generosity. I'll keep you posted as to when the Sounds of Freedom Band is performing once again. And if you missed that concert the other day, hopefully you'll be there next time. Maybe you'll hear a little bit of their music before the program is done today. Since I was downtown last week, while this program was on, we had to record it ahead of time. And in playing back that program, we inadvertently eclipsed some of the interview with Guy Harden of Hamford, the Pearl Harbor survivor who you heard from last week. I did want to bring you some of the more interesting parts of his story that you didn't get to catch surrounding what he experienced that Sunday morning. He had gone out to play tennis with a friend by the name of Don Morgan, and as they were playing tennis that match, I guess we'll never know who the winner of that match would be because their match was interrupted by planes flying overhead. And here's where Guy Harden picks up the story from there.
Look at those planes up in the air. So I looked up, and just as I looked up, the first plane turned his nose down and dropped a bomb. I thought, oh, wow, what? For the past two Sundays, we'd already had dogfights in the air with our own airplanes anticipating war. They would dive bomb, they would go straight up, and they would dogfight, and they would put on quite a show. So that's what I thought it was, because the other planes that were in the air were like a flock of birds up there, and each one knowing the sequence that they would follow. So after he dropped his bomb, then the second one, the third one, they all followed. And a few seconds later, playing tennis, we weren't playing at that moment. A few seconds later, an airplane came behind us, came around behind the building where our dormitory was, and the airplane flew right over the tennis court. There were four tennis courts, and we were standing right in the middle, and he flew over the wire fence around the tennis court. And here was a black airplane with a red rectangle, and then at the corner of the rectangle was a red rising sun. And I turned to, and a bright shiny torpedo underneath. Mm-hmm. And I turned to Don and I said, look at that. They even made it, painted the airplanes to make them look like Japanese. And I still had no clue of what was going on, though I'm hearing bombs going off everywhere and guns shooting. The 5 seconds later or so, the second airplane came around the building, looked exactly, it was another torpedo plane. The rear gunner turned his guns around and fired right into our faces. And I thought, whoa, you crazy so-and-sos, you're liable to hit somebody doing that. But I'm looking right straight up the barrels of that machine gun. I don't know if it was one barrel or two, but I was looking right straight up there, and little puffs of smoke coming out as the bullets came out. And it must have either God's providence that provided safety for me, or the bullets were going right over my head at some other target, possibly a submarine tied up at the dock just beyond us. I don't know. But I was ready to really chew him out. Anyway, about that time...
Because you still thought at this point, this is an American plane and these are just maneuvers.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I thought. There were motor torpedo boats along the dock just beyond the tennis courts. And a tall, lanky sailor from those boats came walking across so nonchalantly, said, hey, you guys better get out of here. That's the Japanese. Well, he didn't have to tell me twice. I took off, and I don't know. I don't remember any sense of being scared or fearful. But on the other hand, I look back on it, and I say, why did I run up and to the barracks, up to where my bunk was on the top floor of that four-story building. And just as I reached the bunk, the loudspeaker, some voice said, clear the building. I said, okay, where am I going to go? To myself. Anyways, I was running down the hall to get to my bunk, and why I was running, I don't know, but maybe to get my hat on. I didn't have a hat yet, didn't have a T-shirt, just out there in my shorts and tennis shoes. Mm-hmm. I broke the crystal on my watch, and I reached over to get the door to open it, and as I did, my hand went against the doorknob, broke the crystal. That was the only injury I had. At any rate, I got my hat, went downstairs to clear the building, stepped outside the back, and just stood up against this cement wall of the building, watching the activity going on out from me, which was, I think, one of our own airplanes, a transport of some kind. It wasn't a fighter plane of any kind, but the side door or something was slid open. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming they were taking pictures of what was going on. Mm. At any rate, our own ships were firing at this one airplane, and the shells would burst just before it got to there. Whether anybody there received any shrapnel, I don't know. But while I'm watching that action, all of a sudden I see something coming at me, and I just froze. I didn't move because it was so fast. And it was a piece of shrapnel that bounced in the pavement ahead of me and bounced up against the wall right next to my ear. Mm. And I picked that up and looked at it. It was about the size of my middle finger and about 3 or 4 inches long. At the end of each end were sharp needle-like different lengths. Probably the longest one would be about an inch. I said, boy, I'm glad that thing didn't hit me in the cheek or in the face or anywhere on my body.
How close did it come to you?
Right next to my ear above my shoulder.
Like within an inch or two?
I would say so. Yeah.
You could feel the heat of it that close?
I saw it coming, and I didn't move. I just watched it come bang right there it was. And I picked it up and looked at it. I said, I don't need this, and I threw it back down. And I regretted that because I would have cherished it as a souvenir. And again, I consider I was very fortunate, God watching over me. It wasn't my time, and I certainly didn't want to be wounded by that piece of shrapnel because it was really coming.
So again, that was the Reverend Guy Hardin of Hanford remembering his experience at Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. We too are thankful that it wasn't his day that day, that he was able to share those memories with us. I apologize that technical glitch prevented you from hearing all of that last week, and I'm glad we were able to bring the rest of it to you this afternoon. Now we continue with this week's guest here on the program, and he too is a Navy man, but he was doing something a little bit different. He was way up high in a blimp. Now, Don Potts of Fresno is our guest, and Don, how often do you tell people that you flew blimps during World War II and get a very puzzled look on that person's face?
Well, occasionally they want to know what it is. And I say, well, it's kind of like the Goodyear blimp, but a lot larger. We had a crew of 10, and we'd take off from usually 10 to 18 hours, maybe a little longer, and we'd poke around out in the Atlantic looking for submarines.
I know there's some good stories that we're going to get to along those lines. But talking about Guy Hardin and his Pearl Harbor experience, you were back here in the valley when Pearl Harbor happened, but that was a very powerful experience for you, too. You'd already graduated from Fresno High. You're a student at Fresno State at that time. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
I remember on Sunday morning, my dad came in and woke me up and told me what had happened. And we realized that we had a problem as a nation. Next day, I went to Fresno State, and a day later, I went down and joined the Navy as an apprentice seaman. I remember I came back and talked to Dean Briggs, who was the dean of students at that time, and he said, don't be too hasty here. They'll come through and offer all you guys a chance at officer's training. I said, no, I think I better go. And it wasn't long after I was down in San Diego in boot camp that I think I knew what he was talking about.
Maybe I should have listened to the dean a little bit more. This isn't what I envisioned. Well, we're going to talk about all the things that Don Potts experienced during World War II, his time in the Navy, flying blimps, doing all sorts of stuff. It's going to be a very interesting conversation. Right now, we need to catch our first commercial break. But when we come back, we'll get into the thick of things, what he saw during his time in the Navy in World War II. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Recognize that melody, String of Pearls, by the late, great Glenn Miller. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Sunday afternoon. Our guest this week, Don Potts of Fresno, a Navy veteran of World War II. He was on a ship, I guess you could say, but not on the water. We're talking airships, blimps, but when we left off before the break, he had just enlisted in the Navy, ignoring the advice of his dean at Fresno State, and joining up with the Navy. Ended up down at boot camp, and I guess that was a little bit of an awakening for you?
Very much.
What was the biggest shock to your system, would you say?
I think cold beans on Saturday morning.
Wasn't what you got at home, huh?
Not what I was used to.
Did you instantly hit it off with the other guys that you served with? Was there some instant camaraderie there?
Well, I went down with several. When we left on the train, we had, I think there were six of us from Fresno that went down, and we were all, in the same company or something in the training program down there. We all went different ways. One of them, Kosmoski, ended up playing baseball for a while. He was quite a pitcher here locally in those days, in high school.
Mm-hmm. And what did you end up doing? You had a pretty plum job as it ended up
once
you got through that.
After I was through boot camp, I was sent to the hospital corps school out in Balboa Park. And when I finished up that little tour, they sent me up to the Norco Hospital just out of Corona.
Mm-hmm.
This was an old Norconian resort, which was a beautiful layout. We were eating off of the Lake Narconian China until we broke all the plates. And we were primarily picking up the Pearl Harbor victims and rehabbing up there. We had a team of doctors and nurses from the Mayo Clinic that came out, and they staffed the hospital. And then as time went along, I ended up lifeguarding the swimming pool, which was where they had the 1932 Olympic tryouts.
Mm-hmm.
And from another fellow in Fresno, Art Wilcox, the two of us ended up lifeguarding that pool for quite some time. If they had some interesting surgery, they'd come down and gown us up and take us up in the operating room and watch it. And we had to do certain training programs. But basically, we lifeguarded the pool.
Tough life.
Yeah, it was pretty tough. And I put in for Navy flight training, and I was lucky enough to get it.
Let me ask you, though, being there, and you talked about the event of Pearl Harbor and hearing about it here from your father when you were in Fresno, how powerful it was for you, obviously motivated you to sign up right then. You weren't going to wait. When you were down there at this facility where all the patients are guys who were wounded there, was that something else that kind of firmed up your resolve and made you really want to win this war?
Oh, very definitely, yeah.
Yeah, what kinds of things did you see there?
Oh, everything from lost limbs to lost eyes to one kid that I remember particularly, his hands were pretty badly crippled up, missing fingers, and yet he had a good spirit about him, but he used to come down at the pool and we'd sit around and talk quite a bit, and he wasn't much older than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just barely 18 by a month when I enlisted.
But pretty soon you had some more fun equipment to play with. You said you put in for flight training.
Put in for flight training was, told me I was going to St. Mary's pre-flight. And just about a week before I was to go to pre-flight, I got fleet orders to go aboard an LST down in transfer unit in San Diego. And I thought, well, there goes the flight training, but... As luck would have it, when I got down there, they looked at my orders and said, oh, you're supposed to go to St. Mary's. You better take a week off.
Tough again. You're catching breaks here.
And then I ended up at St. Mary's. And when I graduated, they took seven of us from the class and sent us to Moffett Field to train to fly blimps. Well, that was fine with me. I'd been following that ever since my dad took me to see the Macon there in the hangar. Before it had crashed.
Now, tell me about this. You go down to San Diego, they tell you you're going to get on an LST. Maybe some of our listeners don't realize the significance of that. If you get on that, if you're shipped out to the South Pacific, you think you're sitting here talking to me right now?
No. It was landing ship tanks. It would make a beach landing to unload the tanks and, mm-hmm. and the other equipment. And it was not a great place to be in a landing.
So when they told you, we made a mistake, we don't need you to take a week off, you were a pretty relieved guy.
Very, very much. Just a series of luck all the way through.
Well, and you mentioned having seen the Macon. The Macon was one of the earlier blimps.
The old, like the Graf Zeppelin, it wasn't a blimp. It was a dirigible. It was a rigid.
And for those at home, explain that difference. Some people think blimp, dirigible are synonymous.
Well, a blimp... really is derived from the word the British had during World War I called B-class limp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the air pressure or the gas pressure keeps the shape of the basic shape of the blimp, where the rigid, like the Macon, had a aluminum frame and the gas bags are all internal in there.
Mm-hmm. So when you had first gotten this taste of these crazy flying machines, there was some interest that was piqued at that point, kind of stayed in your mind this whole time?
Yeah, when I graduated, actually after I went from Moffett Field, I went to back to Lakehurst for the last part of the training.
That's in New Jersey, right?
Back to New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I graduated back there and got my commission, and I was sent down to ZP-21 in Florida. And the first crew I flew with, they said, you ought to get in our crew. We're going down to Gitmo, which is Guantanamo Bay. We're going down there for 5 weeks extended duty. It's great duty down there. And so I put in, and I got assigned to that crew. Well, that turned into a extended duty of 6 months there and 6 months down in the jungle in Trinidad.
You never get the whole story up front, do you?
Well, things just happen pretty fast.
Let's set the scene, too, a little bit for our listeners. And this is part of, some people might hear it referred to as LTA or Lighter Than Air. That was the name of the program.
Yeah, LTA.
And at the outset of the war, and you were there not long after the war started, but the outset of the war, I understand there was only 100 pilots anywhere?
Very, very few pilots. They were just, Navy was just starting to expand. They were taking, they took some of the old, the smaller ships from Goodyear.
Mm-hmm.
And incorporated into the Navy, and then they built the larger K ships, which we were flying. And give you an idea of the size of the ship, the car or the gondola was the size of a Greyhound bus.
Mm-hmm.
We had a crew of 10. We had a couple of machinists, mechanics. We had a rigger. We had radio operators, radar operators. And we'd have either 3 to 4 pilots.
And that's just the gondola, like you say, the actual entire blimp.
The bag was above us, and it...
And several times your size.
Many, many times.
This is a pretty big thing that you're piloting through the skies.
It's a pretty good operation. It's not, once you're up, it's fine. You take off, you have one wheel, which you land and take off on. But once you're in the air, it's fine. But it's coming in for the landing sometimes that if you're too light, you have to, and we tried never to valve helium because it was practically a court-martial offense if you you valve that stuff. But we'd come in, if we were too light, we'd come down and you had to have a whole ground crew to grab your long lines and pull you down to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you got on the mast, then you were all right. But it was a pretty complicated operation.
Well, you know, airplane pilots, fighter pilots, bomber pilots tell me the same thing. It's getting up and getting down are the problems. And, you know, the first guy I ever heard that from was the late, great Dutch Warmerdam.
Oh, for crying out.
He used to say that about pole vaulting. He said, getting up is not the problem, it's landing. Yeah. Back then, they didn't have these big padded mats that they have now.
Well, and he didn't have any fiberglass pole either.
If he had, he would have been having a harder time getting down because he would have been flying 25 feet in the air probably. He went 15 on a bamboo pole. But we digress here. We're talking to Don Potts today. He was one of the rare World War II veterans who flew blimps during that conflict. We're going to talk when we come back about why the blimps were needed, what purpose they served, and what kind of duties Don had during his time flying blimps. He flew a few planes during the war, too, and we're going to talk about some of those harrowing experiences just about halfway through today on this edition of Hometown Heroes. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at KMJ580.com.
Anchors Away, performed by the Sounds of Freedom Band. Hopefully you caught the concert last Sunday. I'll keep you posted as to when the next concert is coming up for that local band made up of people age 14 to 90. You can believe that. Anchors Away, fitting this week because we're joined by another Navy veteran of World War II. Most of his work during the war was not on the water. It was about 500 feet above the water, flying a blimp for the U.S. Navy. It's Don Potts of Fresno with us today. And Don, let's talk about why they had the blimps in operation. The U-boats were a pretty strong threat at this point, right?
In 1942, the beaches along the Florida coast and the East Coast were just, talk about pollution and oil. They were washing up on the shore. They were sinking ships faster than they could make them at that time. And the blimps came along and pretty much they would do the convoy duty out about 300 miles. And it pretty well put the kibosh, and then when the little postage stamp carrier came along, they could have air cover there. So by the end of 1943, the submarine menace was pretty well under control. It wasn't quite the disaster it started out, but it was very, very serious at the beginning.
I think I read somewhere that there were 89,000 American ships escorted by blimps during the war, and exactly zero were sunk.
That's my understanding, too.
That's a pretty good record.
Well, I guess you could say it pretty good.
Now, what kind of weaponry did you have? How can a blimp protect a convoy?
We could carry up to four depth charges, and we had a 50 caliber in the turret. We had a BAR that we could use if we had to, but the basic armor was the 50 caliber and the Torpex bombs. And we primarily used radar. We did a lot of night flying and using the radar to try to pick up subs. In my particular case, we never picked one up. However, I did get to go aboard a sub down in Key West one time on an ASW training mission, and every time it surfaced, I got seasick.
Well, I bet you had to duck a little bit in the halls of that thing, too.
Well, it leaked like a sieve.
I have so much respect for the men who served on submarines during World War II because they were such a far cry from the technology we have today for submarines.
Well, we always kind of joshed with them and said, nothing says that you have to come up, but we have to come down.
That's true. That's a pretty good dichotomy working for you there. You made reference before of going down to Guantanamo and what that turned into. What were some of the more interesting experiences of that deployment, that time that you spent down in the tropics?
We would go out with the papers or the orders for the convoy, and we'd make an airdrop to them. We'd meet them down in the channel into Cuba, on the east end of Cuba, usually, and make an airdrop where we'd drop a line over the head of the operation there, and then he'd get his orders, because he didn't really know where they were going on the convoy either.
So they're kind of like the parents waiting around for the stork to drop the kid. They're the convoy waiting around for the blimp to drop the orders.
Right.
Was that easy to do, or were there ever any misadventures trying to get those orders to the right place?
We occasionally knocked down their antennas and things like that.
Oops.
But they could recover. We had one interesting experience. We used to have some SBDs at the base down there, and they used to come in and kind of buzz us. And
those are dive bomber planes, for those of you who don't know.
And give us a little problem until we were in the club one night, and I said, you know, we're dropping about 125 feet of steel antenna, and that's the last time we had one buzz us.
They realized they were messing with trouble if they buzzed you, huh? And you said you never saw any U-boats, all the patrols that you did looking for submarines. You did see a few interesting things, though.
We saw whales. We saw sharks. I took pictures of a couple of whales. We saw that was kind of exciting in its own way.
Did anyone think they were anything other than whales, or did you instantly know they were whales?
No, they were close to the surface. And down there, the water was pretty clear, so we could make them out right away.
How low would you go?
We generally flew between 400 and 500 feet, and very seldom went any higher.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the standard that everyone flew at.
Is it a pretty smooth ride?
It can be, or it can be kind of rough, depending on the weather. I remember one time we were taking a blimp up the west coast here, and we were going up the Oregon coast watching a big gasoline tanker on the crooked highway. We had a headwind. He actually beat us.
You weren't setting any speed records.
We weren't setting any speed records. We could do in calm weather, we could do about 60 knots, and that was it.
Well, and you think about the surface area that one of those blimps has, there's a lot of wind resistance potential there. You talked about the whales. I remember when we caught up with you on television, you also told me a story about seeing some sharks and actually trying to warn someone were there.
We were flying up to a little island, and we could see the kids swimming, and just beyond where they were was the biggest darn shark I've ever seen in my life. And
holy moly.
We dropped some flares to try to point it out to them, and they didn't seem to heed it. And finally, we underlimbered the 50 caliber and let a few rounds go, and they got the message then, and they got off up on the beach.
So they thought you're some crazy guys trying to kill them.
But that was the biggest shark I think I've ever seen from the air.
Did you try to hit the shark with your 50
caliber? We tried, but I'm sure we didn't.
Yeah. I imagine you all got to take a little target practice with those guns on the blimp.
We had to test them every time we went up and fire a few rounds just for make sure they were working. We had one blimp actually shot down in the squadron down there out of Miami. And they made a perfect drop, straddled the depth charges. And the blimp, they weren't sure they armed them. Later, they found out they did do some damage to the sub. I just read an article on it a while back. And but the sub unlimbered their 5-inch and shot the blimp down. Everyone survived except one of the crew members.
I've read some interesting stories, and I know that you've read as much as anyone about blimps. There's also a story about a blimp that came back unmanned one time?
The L-8, flying out of Moffett. And
that's in the Bay Area, for those of you who aren't familiar.
In the Bay Area.
And the hangars are still there when you drive by?
The hangars are still there. And the story on this was the two fellas that were flying the blimp went out around the Farallons. They made radio contact. And then for something that... The blimp landed all by itself, but no pilots. And it's been a mystery to this day of what happened to those two pilots.
Do you have a favorite theory?
There are several theories, but I don't have the slightest idea what happened.
Nobody really knows.
That car, incidentally, I just read in our organization, has just been restored at Pensacola and is in the museum.
Hmm. What's it like for you when you get together with other blimp pilots and other veterans who did the same kind of things you did?
Oh, we talk about our days being cadets and training and some of the crazy things that happened and where we were and what we did. And we try to get together every 2 years on a reunion.
I know there are many more experiences that hopefully we're going to have time to hear about from you. But the time that you did spend down in the Caribbean and that part of the world, was it something that you think opened your eyes a little bit, gave you some perspective on life in general, to see how other people lived and to be exposed to these other cultures?
We had one of the fellows in the squadron who had a brother who was a missionary down in Haiti, and occasionally we'd fly down there and drop some supplies off. He'd write a letter, and so we'd arrange to make a little drop, just a few items.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked pretty bad even in those days.
Kind of makes you thankful for what you have.
You're right.
And all the times that you went up in the air in one of those blimps, never got shot at?
As far as I know, and I almost feel embarrassed that I had such good luck. I just can't believe that I could go through 4.5 years of the Navy and not be shot at.
Well, I'm glad that you did, because otherwise you might not be here talking to me.
Right.
I'm glad that you are, and I know you did have some close calls, and the weather tried to take you down, and I want to hear about that when we come back. And I also want our listeners to find out about the nickname that you ex-blimp pilots have for that wonderful craft that you flew for so long. So that is still to come. We'll come down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes with Don Potts next.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Remember Artie Shaw and Stardust. Don Potts does. He remembers a whole lot from the World War II era. Spent 4.5 years in the Navy during that time. Served our country for long after that. And spent many years in the skies flying those giant flying machines. Although they knew them as something else, the blimp pilots back then. And I guess still have their own little nickname for blimps. And some of you might be taken aback by this nickname. Go ahead, Don. Fire away.
Well, when we got the blimps down on the ground at night, we have a gas bag inside the bag itself is filled with helium.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have two chambers called ballonets, which we pump air into. And at night, as the air cools down, the gas tends to contract, and you have to pump air in to keep the shape of the blimp in some semblance.
Right.
And then when it heats up, then the gas expands and the ballonets start to expel a little air. And
so it has to go somewhere.
So we just had kind of a favorite name called a poopy bag.
Because it made a very loud and
very
noticeable
loud,
sound.
Very loud, like a poopy cushion.
Uh-huh. So there you go. The blimps were giant whoopee cushions, and they call them poopy bags. In fact, do they still publish that newsletter?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We get it, the noon balloon to Rangoon, we get about once a month.
I thought I saw one that was called the Poopy Bag Express or something
that
like
was,
that. Too.
That was the other,
uh-huh.
The old newsletter.
An inside joke for those who have spent time around blimps in the Navy. And you mentioned a museum in Pensacola, and there's also something up in Oregon, right?
Up in Tillamook, there's an old hangar up there. There's not much left of the blimp operation, but they have a whole series of World War II planes there that's rather fun to go through.
Now, blimps weren't the only thing that you spent time in. After it was pretty clear that U-boat threat was ended, you had different assignments. Let's talk about that.
After 1943, they decided to phase out the blimp operations down in Trinidad, and so I came back to the States, went to a navigation training program in aerial navigation, and was assigned to the Naval Air Transport Service out in Honolulu, which was a very good duty. We flew the R-5Ds, or the Army version would be the C-54, a beautiful plane.
Nice big plane.
Big plane, and we'd fly west and going to the different islands and delivering supplies and personnel. And if we were lucky, we'd get a trip back to Oakland every once in a while, which was very good duty because we were on a what they call the first in, first out, and it may take 10 days of calling in each morning to find out if we're on the flight list.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad. Oh, you would run into some harrowing experiences, though, during those duties. And I know one of the things you did, too, was you'd pick up injured soldiers or shell-shocked soldiers?
We'd bring back some of the hospital patients. And the one flight that I remember particularly, they were all strapped down to their gurneys. And we had, I think, five nurses aboard that trip. And we were flying from Samar down the Philippines back to Guam. And we hadn't been in the air about 30 minutes. We hit the intertropical front. We couldn't navigate. We couldn't see a star. Radio reception was poor. And finally, we got over where I thought we should be, over the airport at Guam.
Not that you have any way of telling, because you can't see a thing.
Finally, we were able to see some lights down there and mm-hmm. Called in on the radio, and no answer. And finally, we just said, we're coming in. Give us the red light if it's not safe. And
did you have to go in because the fuel wouldn't last much longer?
No. We'd flown a pretty good distance at that stage. We were running on empty.
Mm-hmm. So this is almost a life or death situation you got going here.
And as we hit the ground, no lights came on or anything. We figured, something's going on, and we hit all four throttles and took off. We just lost a plane there the week before, and about 24 people were killed when they hit the mountain next to the runway there.
Holy moly.
And
so you touched down and then take off again.
And then we took off again, and then and then we started to see other planes and talk to them on the air up above, and everyone is trying to figure out what's wrong. We can't contact the tower down there, and finally we said, we're just coming in blind, and we're going to land. We have to.
Were you holding your breath?
Kind of.
Saying a couple prayers?
Yeah. And we got down safely and found out they changed radio frequencies and sent out a notam, but apparently didn't get as far as Samar.
Oh, my goodness.
And but eventually all the aircraft got down safely.
Would you say that was the scariest moment you had during the war?
One of them. But basically, I was pretty lucky. I didn't have to. I feel kind of embarrassed about it when I think of all my buddies that went through so many battles, and some of them made it and some didn't.
Now, when you think about, you think back to flying those planes when you had, like you said, the soldiers strapped down to gurneys or being taken back for medical attention, etc. Was that something, again, that for you was powerful? I mean, did that tell you this is the price of freedom? This is what we're here for?
Very much so. It's the whole operation. I just wish we had the same feeling today about our service people that we had then.
Well, hopefully this show can do something about that. And people hearing you say that today, hopefully they'll be inspired to have that same feeling. You told me before that, and I've heard a lot of veterans say this, you think every young person should have to spend some time in the military?
I really think that there should be a program that when a youngster graduates from high school, that he should have a year or two to do some type of service for this country to make him feel that it's not a free ride.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care whether he serves in the military or in the hospital corps or whatever it is, that he gives some time to kind of pay back all the good things that happened to us, because I don't think the young people appreciate it. I doubt if I did either at that time. But
well, I think we can all appreciate it more. There's so much that we take for granted in this country, and it's easy to forget what the price of freedom really is and what those so many people paid that price for us during World War II. More than 400,000 Americans died during World War II so we could enjoy the freedom that we enjoy today. I know that you don't take that for granted, Don. And well, let's talk about this real quick. We've got a few minutes left, about 5 minutes. Where were you when you found out it's all over? I get to go home.
I was in, actually I was in Hawaii at that time, in Honolulu. And when the war was over, we'd just heard about the atomic bomb had gone off, and we didn't know what the heck they were talking about.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize atomic bomb wasn't in the vocabulary for anyone.
We'd never heard anything about it, and we didn't know what it was. And then it was just a few days after that they dropped the second one, and then it was over.
You were in the place where the war had started for America.
Right, that's right.
And now the war was over. Do you remember what it felt like to come back home to Fresno?
It took me a while to get back to Fresno. I ended up down in the Los Angeles area and went to work for an insurance company. Then I was transferred to San Francisco, and I was there about 8 months, and I said, I can't stand this damn city. I'm going back to Fresno where I'm close to the mountains and away from the crowds, and I've never regretted it.
Well, and our signal's pretty strong. They might be hearing that in San Francisco. We won't give them your address. But you actually had kind of a small world experience on your way home from the service. Tell me about that. You're on a plane?
When they decommissioned the squadron down in Trinidad, I had to bum a ride back to the States. They kind of said, go find a ride back.
So this is before you did everything in the Pacific?
Yeah, this was December of 43, and I went over to the VJ squadron, which was the utility squadron, and there was an A-26 crew over there with an A-26, and I kind of bummed a ride with them. And so I was sitting down below the wing, and the guy was up in the turret, and we got to talking about, boy, I'll sure be glad to get back in the United States. And he said, boy, will I. And pretty soon we said, not be glad to get back to California. He said, boy, will I. And I said, you know, I'd even like to get back to Fresno. He said, me too. And it was Dick Regnard, who I'd gone to school with at Fresno High.
What a small world it is. That's really neat. We've got just a few minutes left in the show. Anything that I didn't ask you about blimps, or that you think maybe there's any misconceptions that people should understand about what it takes to fly a blimp and what it's all about?
Well, I think in those days it was kind of interesting because it really took two pilots to fly one. We had one on what we call the elevator, which controlled the elevation.
Uh-huh.
And then we had a rudderman, a pilot who carried like a steering wheel of a car, and he'd do the steering.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have it all hydraulically controlled and
foot pedals or something.
Foot pedals and it's much more efficient.
So it took some teamwork back then.
It took some good teamwork, particularly on a landing.
Oh, I bet, and I'm sure they weren't all smooth as butter.
Oh no, we had one crash I was involved in down in Gitmo where we came in and had one ship on the mast, and the wind was kind of crazy. We came down and touched down, and the wind gust took us back up in the air, and we, as we went over the other ship, we saw the shadow of three men hanging on the rail.
Oh my goodness.
On the handrail. So we immediately put full rudder down, or full elevator down, and just literally crashed into the runway. Well, it was fine for two of them. They dropped off and we're all right, but one kid was pretty badly crushed.
So basically you took them for a ride up in the air.
A real ride, yeah.
Wow,
and there was a standing all through cadets, everything. It would never let your feet leave the ground. Well, that's easier said than done.
When the wind pops up like that.
It just does it so fast that it's, I got carried aloft and when I was a cadet, we were putting a blimp in a hangar. And just, we started into the door of the thing, and the next thing I knew, I was 50 feet in the air.
That's pretty scary. Well, I'm glad you came back down.
And
not that you always have your feet on the ground. I'm sure you're walking on air some days. But We appreciate you taking the time to share those memories with us. Thank you for your service to our country, Don, and for encouraging the rest of us to serve as well. Don Potts was our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition. Don't forget, you can go online, kmj580.com, to catch any of the Hometown Heroes episodes if you've missed them. Thanks for listening today on News Talk 580 KMJ.